constant work. You know, a young woman, Topacio Reynoso, was murdered.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African Current Affairs brought to you on CQT 90.3 FM. And tonight I'm sitting here with Doug, and we're really devoting most of the show to a book that is not strictly speaking about Africa at all. It's called Fighting a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada. It is written by Samir Shaheen Hussein, who is an emergency pediatrician here in Montreal at the Montreal Children's Hospital. So kind of something that's off the beaten track for us here on Amandla, but Doug and I had the most amazing discussion with Samir yesterday about his book, and that's what we'll be presenting to you tonight. But it begs the question, why are we doing this?
Well, and for me, it was so striking to hear a medical professional on a national CBC radio use the term medical colonialism. We at Amandla have dedicated our show in large part to discussing the continuing colonial project in Africa and what it takes and the trauma that it's left and the exploitation that it still implies and what goes on. And to here in Canada, we tend to think of ourselves as benign and humanitarian, and it's not like that here. But in fact, when you look at the history of relations with Indigenous people, and in this case through the eyes of a medical professional, it's absolutely shocking and outrageous and ongoing and not changing very fast at all. So it just became clear to us that as an educational tool, the concepts of colonialism and the background to colonialism and the underlying racism of colonialism is important to talk about. And boy, does Samir ever do that ever so well. So that's why I felt like it was important that we just let him go and talk about it. The carryover for those of you that are familiar with Africa or learning about Africa will be evident and will be with you for a long time.
So enjoy. We'll be going to a little musical break and then we'll come back with the interview with Samir Shaheen Hussein.
Pretty brown, you're a song that I can't keep from singing. Pretty brown, as you move, you don't know that you're winning. And your eyes say you lost like an autumn leaf spinning. Turn around, dry your eyes, pretty brown. In the city, did you find the good times you had in mind? Reservation, child, the city's not your home. Put it behind, turn round your mind, and you will find you smile, pretty brown. Pretty brown, you're a song that I can't keep from singing. Pretty brown, as you move, you don't know that you're winning. And your eyes say you lost like an autumn leaf spinning. Turn around, dry your eyes, pretty brown. You're a stranger in the town, and your world has tumbled down. But there's a million wishing they were young as you. So let it go, just let it go. Before you know, you laugh, pretty brown. Pretty brown, you're a song that I can't keep from singing. Pretty brown, as you move, you don't know that you're winning. And your eyes say you lost like an autumn leaf spinning. Turn around, dry your eyes, pretty brown. Let your black hair hang down low, dance like we did long ago, and the beating of the drum will set you free. Just give it time, soon you'll do fine. Your sun will shine once more, pretty brown. Pretty brown, you're a song that I can't keep from singing. Pretty brown, as you move, you don't know that you're winning. And your eyes say you lost, like an autumn leaf spinning. Turn around, dry your eyes, pretty brown. Turn around, dry your eyes, pretty brown.
Well, we have on Zoom with us this evening Samir Shaheen Hussain, pediatrician at the Children's Hospital. Back in September, there was the outrageous event where an Indigenous lady in the St. Jerome Hospital was just absolutely humiliated, the indignity she had to submit to as a sick person, and eventually died of neglect, virtually manslaughter in my mind. Joyce Echtquan was all the news for the treatment that she had received, and the scandalous where it all came from was just scandalous. And I heard an interview in one of the CBC radio shows with Samir, during the course of that interview, he, a medical doctor from the establishment here in Canada, used the expression medical colonialism, and I must have fallen off my chair. I couldn't believe the CBC didn't beep it out of the language because of the way they sanitize all that discussion around Indigenous relations. And so I immediately got on to my friend Uli Gierstad, and we tracked him down at the Children's, and he's been in touch with us and very kindly got us complimentary copies of his book so we could read it and do an interview. And so he's with us here on the line. Good evening, Samir. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, we're extremely excited to have you. And Gwen and I have both read the book and are still as enthusiastic about the way you write and the approach you take and as we were when I heard you speak on the radio. Finally, a voice that questions the actual establishment that we're working in there.
Perhaps we'll just say the title of the book, which is Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada.
Yes, and I'll get to that title in a minute, but Samir, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to gather or gain the awareness about issues around racism and colonialism and Indigenous relations? I think everybody would be interested to know that kind of historic as well, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's always hard to kind of distill, you know, one's life experience in a few minutes, but I guess briefly, you know, I was born in Montreal. I grew up on the South Shore to parents who came here from South Asia as immigrants. And so growing up in a, you know, predominantly white, middle lower class, working class, Francophone neighborhood, as a racialized kid, I experienced racism firsthand, I guess, as a child. And so that has its own implications. And my family, different members of my family have, you know, are engaged in different ways. And, you know, there were even family members back in 1990 when the siege of Canisathage happened, or what's known as the Oka Crisis. There were, you know, family members who went to protest in support of the warriors and of the community of Kanasatage in their land defense. And so those kinds of things obviously played a role probably in my in my development, I guess, even though at that time I would probably not consider myself quote unquote political. But then I think I became much more aware of these issues in medical school itself. Actually, I'd done some work abroad as a medical student that had an impact on my own perception of the world and the recognition of inequalities and injustices. And I also did electives when I was a medical student in Northern Ontario, in Sulukout specifically, working with Indigenous communities. And I think that kind of brought home and highlighted how significant the disparities in health are for Indigenous communities in Canada. And then when I started looking into things, you know, the deeper I looked into things, the more it became very obvious that those inequalities and health disparities are produced, are structural, come from a history, an ongoing reality of colonization and colonialism. So I guess kind of in a quick nutshell, in terms of my kind of background, that's how I came to Indigenous solidarity work. And in 2002, along with others at McGill at that time, we founded the Indigenous People Solidarity Movement, which was initially based at McGill and then moved off campus. Now it doesn't exist anymore, but during the years that it did exist, we did a lot of important work, I think, and also were able to build links and relationships with folks from different Indigenous communities involved in self-determination and sovereignty struggles across the country, which obviously was also incredibly formative for me, because I learned from a lot of the people that we were working with. And that's a whole other kind of learning that can't be taught in schools.
Oh, it hasn't been written yet, that's for sure. Wonderful, that's amazing. So the book, as I understand it, evolved out of your work at the Children's, in fact, where you met Indigenous children who were there all on their own with no capacity to explain their problems to the caregivers with them or that were trying to look after them. Could you give us a little bit of that background, how the book came about?
Of course, yeah. So in 2017, actually, I was working, so I'm a pediatric emergency physician. I was working in the Emerge. I over the span of a few weeks, there were a couple of kids that were transferred from Nunavik. And as was the case for all kids sent to us from Northern Quebec, they were sent alone. And I'm not sure, to be honest, why those two kids had such an impact on me, because I have to say, I did most of my medical schooling here. I did most of my residency at the Children's, and I had been working as a staff since 2009. And so it's not like this was new at all. But for some reason, those two kids in the summer of 2017 really impacted me and haunted me and made me wonder how it is that this practice of non-accompaniment, which was basically a practice that was put in place by EVAC, Évacuation Aéromédicale du Québec, which is basically a government agency responsible for medevac airlifts for the entire province, specifically for rural and remote areas. So they basically had this rule in place to prevent caregivers and parents from accompanying their kids during medevac airlifts. And it was actually a practice, just to be clear, that was implemented and put in place and in effect for all kids across the province. But Indigenous children from Northern Quebec in particular so we're talking about kids from Iwuishi or Cree kids and Inuit kids from Nunavik, they were disproportionately impacted by this practice for a whole slew of reasons. And so, yeah, that's it. So when I started basically looking into the practice, I realized a bunch of stuff. I realized that, you know, Quebec was an outlier. All the other provinces in the country, all the other pediatric centers basically in the country, essentially either allowed or encouraged caregiver accompaniment. The medical literature was clear on this. And I also found that there were, you know, many, many attempts since 1990, early 1990s at least, of people, of communities trying to change this practice. And up until 2018, when we launched our A Hand to Hold campaign, that practice basically continued unabated.
What on earth was the logic behind the Quebec practice? I mean, it makes no sense.
Yeah, so it's initially, you know, to be fair, in quotes, in the 1980s, it's very likely that it probably was standard of care at that time, partly because of space issues on the plane, and a bit of a culture of, you know, physicians know best, and it's probably best not to have family members around. But, you know, as of the 1990s, that culture started to shift, and that's when we saw in other provinces, pediatric centers and medevac services adapting to make sure that kids are accompanied. And certainly by the, you know, 2000s, by the end of, like, you know, around 2010, for sure, almost the vast majority of them would have done that. And so the rationale was, to be honest, the official rationale was basically space, that there wasn't enough space on the Challenger plane. Because sometimes the Challenger plane, which is the air hospital, the flying hospital, has to pick up more than one patient. And so what was also invoked were, like, privacy and confidentiality issues. But at the end of the day, I mean, these were kind of bogus, at least in 2018. Yeah. And so those same excuses that they've been parroting for years just simply didn't apply anymore.
And when there was questioning of Gaétan Barrette, I mean, he even made racist.
The health minister.
The former health minister under the Liberal government, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. Essentially racist excuses. We don't want any drunken people on the plane. My goodness gracious.
Yeah. I mean, that was particularly egregious. And I think it spoke a lot to, you know, it's kind of like in French, there's a saying of, like, you know, he basically said out loud what people think, kind of in the back of their minds kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, it was like you said, it was outrageous. I imagine he wasn't expecting, you know, that conversation that he was having with this member of the public to be recorded, but it was. And regardless, even if it was just a private one-on-one conversation, that's definitely something that's troubling for a health minister to say. And essentially what he said was that he can guarantee that, this is in June of 2018, he said he can guarantee that even when the practice, you know, a child and family friendly policy was going to be put into place, he said that he could guarantee in the next 6 months there would be at least one case of a family that would be refused because of being drugged or under whatever influence, and that happens all the time. And so, you know, that was coming from a health minister. I think it spoke volumes, because anyone can kind of, you know, say that. But systemic, when we talk about systemic racism, it's kind of interesting in this way, because now here you have this health minister, the person who's responsible for implementing policies and law in healthcare, making these kinds of statements. And so as Indigenous leaders and activists said themselves, is that if someone like this, if the health minister says things like this, what does that mean in terms of, one, what's accepted in healthcare from healthcare workers? But two, in terms of how policies are enacted, you know, if it's coming, if you know, the person at the top has these racist stereotypes, what kind of impacts is that going to have in terms of how policies are adopted for Indigenous communities across the board, not only when we're talking about pediatrics, but across the board in the province.
And eventually to the interface with Indigenous people that we saw with Joyce Etchequan. Absolutely.
Right. So totally. Right. Like, so, and this is the question is, you know, one of the things that was very disturbing at the time was that there was, you know, people, were upset when he made those comments. Those comments were made public, but there was a clear call from Indigenous communities for his resignation. And I feel like that didn't really happen. Like that didn't really get echoed and supported outside of Indigenous communities. Which I found was frustrating and very disappointing, obviously, because again, essentially what ended up happening was that this, you know, this former health minister was basically able to make these comments with complete impunity. And like you're alluding to, you know, it sends this message within medical culture, within the healthcare system's culture, that holding such views are acceptable. And tangibly, what that ends up doing is exactly like you just said, that has impacts where people like the nurse and the, you know, the orderly, the patient care attendant, make comments like they did before Joyce Eshequan died, and feel like they're completely legitimate in doing so. And that's just kind of, you know, one example. But when we talk with Indigenous people and different communities, we realize that these kinds of indignities happen on a regular basis, on a daily basis, for so many of these people who are trying to get basic healthcare with dignity.
And the minister's reaction and the reaction of his coterie around him, why should I resign? That's not serious enough to resign about. And the denial of systemic racism throughout Quebec ruling class society is so widespread. And even today, the debate is still going on. Right after Joyce's death, the demands once again, let's discuss systemic racism. Oh, there's no systemic racism. It's a one-off incident. And it manifests itself, as you show in your book, in so many ways, from the policy. Could you just go through that a little bit, how it comes out in policy?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the arguments I make for the non-accompaniment rule, because, you know, there was never a formal policy. There was never a written policy. It was just kind of this thing that, you know, they had decided on initially, and it just got perpetuated, and it got became part of their evacs culture, basically. There was never actually a formal policy. But what I argue is that, you know, whether or not it was intended to discriminate against Indigenous peoples, kids and families when it was established, we'll never really know, because since there was no written policy, we can't trace that back. But what we do know is that when there was a denial to change things after multiple repeated, requests, demands, then at that point, it became an example of medical colonialism. And medical colonialism, I kind of end up rooting historically in terms of the medical establishment's role through practices and policies, to establish, maintain, or advance the genocidal colonial project here in Canada. The examples I draw on are very widespread, but, you know, have to do, when we're talking about, for example, a policy. So one example of a policy would be in the, 1940s, 50s, and 60s, there was a policy basically that was put into place where Inuit who were suspected of having tuberculosis were forcibly transferred to hospitals in the south, so southern hospitals in different cities across Canada for treatment. And I specifically say forcibly because in certain cases, they were basically taken on this ship, the C.D. Howe, to get assessed, to get evaluated. And if they were found to have, to potentially have tuberculosis, in certain cases, especially early on, they weren't even allowed to come off the ship to get their stuff. They were basically just essentially imprisoned on the ship, and then we're going to be brought down to the south for treatment, where on average they would stay for 30 months, so 2.5 years. Wow. And in some cases longer than that, and in many cases these were talking about kids, and kids who were taken alone without their parents or caregivers. So when we kind of look at this kind of a history, we realize that there's a continuity between what happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and what happened, with the evac practice up until 2018. And even there's a bridge. So I write about in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in Quebec specifically, you know, there are many cases of kids from, you know, different communities, Innu, Atikamekw, Anishinaabe or Algonquin, where during medevac, they were taken on medevac flights. This is before AVAC even existed. And would be taken to, either community hospitals or urban hospitals, and they would literally be disappeared into the healthcare system. And this was not a formal policy, but this was kind of just the culture. And so then we see this kind of continuity. And along all of this, there have been physicians who either were at the head of bureaucracies of various arms of the government, or who were kind of the quote unquote foot soldiers to make sure that this was allowed to basically happen and to continue to happen.
And when you say disappear, I mean, they literally disappeared. Some were just literally given to families and adopted out without their parents even being aware of what's going on, and the paperwork, losing track on the paperwork, so they couldn't find their kids, and even kids dying and being buried in community graves and no capacity to retrace them or repatriate them. Astounding behavior.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And for the best of Amandla, please check out our blog, which is amandla.ca, which, by the way, will include in the next week or so the interview that you're listening to now. This is an interview with Samir Shaheen Hussein. He is an emergency pediatrician at the Montreal Children's Hospital and author of the book Fighting for a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada.
I was also interested in how you looked at how the medical establishment recreates itself through the schooling and the education system. I'm an old educator, and how difficult it was even at McGill to change admission standards to allow broader representation from broader sides of society. And I love that term, privilege strikes back. Could you just go into that a little bit as well too?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I guess part of that, the earlier parts of the book, I try to lay down a bit of the groundwork to explain why and how a practice like the non-accompaniment practice can persist as it has. And that can happen because of culture, of medical culture. I look at historical figures that influence medical culture in so many ways, including at McGill, someone like, you know, William Osler, but there are all kinds of other people obviously along the way, and kind of make a link, draw links to how up until the present day, you know, when we're talking about, for example, Indigenous and Black individuals severely, grossly underrepresented in medical schools. And if that's the case, then that's obviously going to have an impact in terms of, the curriculum that people in medical school are going to be exposed to, but also clinical care is going to be impacted. But essentially, when the people in power are, I kind of refer to this old white boys club in the book. So if the people in power are still part of this old white boys club, which is still to a large extent the case even today, and they're the ones who are controlling who gets in, what we're taught, and how we implement practice, then the result is what we kind of, you know, see, whether it was through the non-accompaniment practice, whether it was this denial of the trauma that Indigenous communities were facing, or whether it's through examples like what happened with Joyce Eshequan, and what's ongoing now, where, you know, now you have the family and the community who have put out this Joyce's principle, which is a very impressive, simple set of recommendations. recommendations for the government to adopt. And the government basically refuses to adopt it on the premise that they would have to acknowledge systemic racism, which they still stubbornly refuse to do so.
Absolutely. And even at the medical school, because they did start making changes some of the folks of privilege whose children would have got in because of their status, family status, apparently even donations started going down to McGill because they weren't getting their way. There was one beautiful quote about smart children come from smart parents and smart parents make lots of money, you know, and wow.
Right. That's a whole other thing, right? Like where this educator, this former associate dean had tried to implement, like you were mentioning, try to change admissions practices so that it could be more, basically so it could be more inclusive of people from different backgrounds and different experiences. And that was met with a lot of backlash. And part of that was certainly informed by this, you know, entitlement essentially around legacy admissions, right? Like people who are who are physicians already, who feel like their kids should be entitled to get into medical school as well, without recognizing the systemic barriers that have been put into place that prevent other people from being able to get into professions like medicine for reasons that are completely beyond their control, obviously.
Yes, absolutely. And my goodness, there's so much to go over. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. So, Samir, the book is basically this very eloquent, very political plea for transformational change, that if we're going to see change here, we need to go deep. We need to look at the history of colonialism, that this is a settler colony to this day, and that these policies are simply a manifestation of that structure. It's a plea to look at the nature of capitalism and its role in creating these egregious situations. And you presented this framework or this kind of view at the Viennes Commission. You've obviously spoken to your work colleagues about this and, you know, made the plea for a whole different way of looking at this if we really want to achieve justice. So I'm wondering to what degree is your message embraced by your profession, and to what degree are you facing backlash?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important question. What's interesting is I think it's maybe a bit early to see exactly what kind of reaction it's gonna have. What I will say, so for example, I've written in the book, I mentioned things like I said about, you know, William Osler, and I've written opinion pieces in the Montreal Gazette and the Huffington Post, kind of tied to the theme of like medical monuments. And after those, I've received, you know, some kind of backlash, like, and that's basically people who want to maintain, whatever, this relic of the past. And that's been significant enough, but that was kind of expected, I guess. But what I have to say is what's been encouraging and inspiring in many ways has been that I've been invited to speak at, the Canadian Federation of Medical Students basically organized an event across the country for medical students. I'm just like in discussion right now with the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions. There's several pediatric hospitals that have invited me to speak about the book. And a lot of that for sure is coming from, I guess, newer, younger generation, but not only. I feel like there are also people who have been around for a while who are genuinely trying to engage with these issues. And I think that in the context of what's been revealed through the pandemic, obviously after George Floyd's brutal death, after Joyce Echaquan's brutal death, it's really forced a lot of people who have benefited from all kinds of privilege in the past to start really questioning that privilege, I guess, in many ways. And now, it's interesting because I wrote this book, the manuscript was written in 2019. So it predates the pandemic, it predates all of this stuff. I kind of sometimes joke with friends that I feel like if it would have come out then, it would have been probably considered quote unquote radical. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I almost feel like it's kind of like appropriate for the time, like because things have shifted so much. And the political terrain has shifted so much, in a way where, again, people are really engaging with many of these core issues that many of us have obviously been bringing up for years and decades, right? Like, and it's kind of sad in a way because some of the references I use in the book, I'm talking about references from like the 60s, right? Like in terms of terminology even and whatnot. So people have obviously been doing this kind of work for so long, but there is a thirst, a hunger on the part of many people, including in healthcare, to learn more and to actually tangibly try to change things. So we'll see where that goes. I mean, we know that there's the potential of things getting co-opted, but the hope is that there's going to be change.
So you brought up the pandemic. So finally, that has been raised in this interview. We are in the midst of it, and we're on the cusp of, or the federal government is on the cusp of, rolling out the vaccine here in Canada, and has been very explicit in stating that among the first groups, priority groups to receive the vaccination, will be Indigenous peoples. And so I just would like your comment on that. Does that represent kind of a victory for the struggle that we've been talking about here today, or is there another motivation? So yeah, just your thoughts on that, please, Samir.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to know for certain what kind of other motivations may be there, because, you know, I mean, whatever, there's all kinds of layers to this issue. And when we're talking about vaccines, you know, I talk about the BCG vaccine in the book, about how, you know, it was tested on Indigenous babies and children, right? And so much of our knowledge about the BCG vaccine comes at least partly from that. And so Indigenous communities would potentially be rightly, you know, very much justified in being skeptical and worried about being the first potentially to be vaccinated. You know, and that's not coming from a place where they're quote unquote anti-vaxxers. It's a very different history, right? Like, that being said, on the other hand, what I found interesting, including in speaking with different people over the last several months, has been seeing the different responses to the pandemic by Indigenous communities who have more local control in terms of, you know, ensuring that people aren't coming in and out, be outside of their community. And how, in some cases, they've managed to almost have, you know, like no cases. Like one of the examples that comes to mind is something like Chisasibi, even in Quebec, where you know, the health board, the Cree health board there, has put in measures where, to a large extent, the number of cases have been very, very minimal, and at times have been basically zero. And it just speaks to when people, and this is more broadly even beyond Indigenous communities, but when people have, you know, the power to decide for, you know, for themselves what's best for their communities, that can go a very, very long way. So I guess ultimately my response, I guess, to your question would be that it ultimately depends, I think, on what communities are deciding, in the sense that, as if, you know, if the federal government is allowing vaccines to be available, then I think that's great, so long as Indigenous communities want them, one. But two, the other thing I think that this shouldn't gloss over is the, you know, chronic, constant, and what many label criminal underfunding of many of these communities. So, you know, where there's dozens of communities across Canada, for example, that still have a water advisory, right? Or that, and communities that don't have clean and running water. And so when we're talking about the pandemic, and one of the mainstays, at least early on, was always, you know, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. How are you supposed to wash your hands if you don't have clean and running water, right? And so, yes, I'm sure like the federal government is going to basically try to make themselves look really, really magnanimous by offering the vaccines to Indigenous communities first. But the other issue is that for those communities that are struggling more intensely with the pandemic and with COVID in particular right now, a lot of that is a result of these longstanding colonial policies, and just giving some vaccines is not going to gloss over that.
Thank you so much. That's an amazing, amazing review of the. It brings the history together to the present very, very nicely. I'm also very interested in the issues that Ellen Gabriel brings up in her afterword, and the wonderful element of your book is the foreword by Blackstock. And then Ellen at the end, and so you know you've clearly collaborated very closely with some very important actors in the Indigenous scene, and Ellen brings it up again to the basics, and the basics are you want to talk reconciliation. Well, it's not just words and it's not just apologies. It must go the next step, and okay, that's essentially reparations and restitution. How does that translate in the medical field?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's going to be something that I think, because I mention that as well, like in as I'm kind of closing off the book, is that, you know, we can't talk about reconciliations without reparations. But I think ultimately that's going to come down to many of these Indigenous communities that have been impacted, obviously, to decide how that's going to play out. There are, you know, for example, I talk about in the book, in the section on medical colonialism, I talk about the Indian hospitals. So this like, you know, segregated healthcare system that was in place, to a large extent, for several decades in the 20th century. And there have been, lawsuits that have been filed in that context. Similarly, around the forced and coerced sterilization of Indigenous women, there's a class action lawsuit that's happening. I think, you know, a lot of these things, unfortunately, are happening by lawsuits. And I say unfortunately in the sense that that takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of resources for communities to have to make that happen, with the goal, obviously, of being able to get some kind of compensation. But I think ultimately what a lot of the scholars and activists many of whom are Indigenous, whose work I draw on, I think they are pushing for a more, you know, honest and proactive approach by various levels of government, essentially to support initiatives around sovereignty, autonomy, land back, is kind of what it comes down to. And ultimately, and that's one of the things I tried to tie in, is that connection with the land, which sometimes when in the context of like, you know, healthcare, that may not always be easy to do, but it's so central and it's so core, obviously, one on the one hand for Indigenous communities, but on the other for the colonial project, right? Because that's a core a goal for the colonial project is basically to take land and exploit land and then profit from it. And so so tying that in to making that connection between land and health becomes so important. And obviously many Indigenous communities and leaders are already doing this, but that is so core in so many different ways, like not just about, you know, having access to the land, but even, I mean, Ellen talks about this in her afterword, that there was a time, you know, in the past that people were free to, you know, pick medicines, right? Like before the reserve system was put into place, let's say, and that they were prevented from doing so And so I think it goes, it's very broad. I definitely don't want to be limiting what the potentials are going to be for that. But ultimately, I think it does come down to the land.
Well, you were so good in your book about regularly bringing the reader back to the notion of the cause of the cause.
Right.
You know, and so if you follow that thread deep enough, it takes us to land. And so I liked that about the book, is that I think it's good pedagogy too. It's like why I would like to see this book taught in CEGEPs and universities, because to keep bringing the reader back to that, what's the cause of the cause? Like, let's do history. You know, I think it's also really an acknowledgement of the importance of history, and let's take it back. And why are things like this? So, you know, this is a pitch for your book, Samir, because I want our listeners to
read. My goodness gracious. I can't tell you how enthusiastic I am about it. This could be an aside. I can cut it out of the interview. But I spent the better part of 2019 at the Jewish General with following my wife through a bout of colon cancer and the surgery and the recovery and all of that. About 90 days of a total in that year I spent there. And our best friends were the support staff. And who were they? They were Haitians. They were Africans. They were Filipinos. They were the world. Walked through those corridors, keeping that hospital going. And it occurred to me that right there is a colonial image of migrant labor, cheap labor, people who undervalued labor, insecure people being exploited. They're not getting their worth. And of course, the pandemic has just, bam, brought that right to a head. Sorry for my little interjection there.
No, but I think it does speak to this, you know, this question that people have in the past referred to, even the present day healthcare system as an apartheid system, that impacts, or that you know, we can see in different ways, but certainly, I mean, you know, my book focuses on the medical establishment's role vis-a-vis indigenous communities, but as you've mentioned, you know, there's all kinds of other communities that have been and that continue to be exploited, either in terms of when they're, you know, in terms of not being able to receive proper healthcare and dignified healthcare, despite doing some of the, you know, most dangerous, lowest paying jobs in our society, or on the other end, having again some of the worst paying and most insecure jobs within healthcare itself, and so so that's something that, you know, obviously has to come to an end, but that's going to take a little bit of time for that to happen. But my hope is that, as I think Gwen was alluding to, is, you know, the hope really is that the book kind of opens. Forces doors open, so that people can continue to do this kind of work, and so that those who have already been doing this kind of work, because I can't tell you how many times I've spoken at events and there have been Indigenous folks in attendance who, during the discussion period, will end up, you know, chiming in to say, you know, we've been saying this for years, and they're always appreciative of the book. But I also feel and completely understand a certain level of frustration in their voice, because they've been bringing this up for years and decades and have not been getting the attention and the respect that they deserve.
Wow. I think that almost makes a very lovely, timely conclusion. Unless you have another word you'd like to add to wrap it up, I think... Well, on my part, thank you so much, Samir. From the time I heard your voice on CBC to now, I've enjoyed your company through the book and now face to face. So thanks for this, and we wish you all the best. And you certainly have two advocates for that book in the Amandla here, and we'll promote it all we can.
Thank you so much. No, I think it was a really great, great, like, meeting you two virtually and being able to chat. It was a real pleasure, and I'm thankful that you reached out.
It's been amazing. Thank you so much. And yes, you may not have initiated the conversation, but I really do feel like the book is helping to keep it alive, and, as you said, pushing open some doors that are you know, pretty resolutely shut. And I think that's really a fantastic thing. And yeah, we're definitely going to encourage as many people as possible to read this and, more importantly, do something.
Au clair de la lune, mon ami Zongo refusa de baïonner sa plume au Burkina Faso. Et Zongo est mort, brûlé par le feu. Que justice soit faite pour l'amour de Dieu. Entre le marteau et l'enclume, les plumes se barricadent derrière leur une. La liberté y a laissé des plumes. Journaliste incarcéré, journaliste assassiné, les voix des sans-voix tuées, tout ça doit changer. La démocratie du plus fort.
Dans notre pays, les gens se sont enrichis de façon foudroyante et vertigineuse. Ça rend fou. Il faut comprendre qu'on ne vit plus le même monde. Donc, il faut avoir clairement à l'esprit ceci. Nous ne vivons pas le même monde. Chacun n'a qu'à réfléchir de toutes les façons. Il y a un qui me disait la dernière fois, parce qu'il est venu chercher ma bouche, comme on le dit en Afrique, et il est venu avec des casquettes et des t-shirts du chef de l'État, et il m'a dit, ou bien vous n'aimez pas ça, vous n'acceptez pas ça dans votre maison. Je dis, si, pourquoi pas, si tu en as beaucoup, tu amènes, il faut poser. S'il y en a, il y a des gens dans ma maison qui en veulent, qui les emportent. Je dis, parce que ceux qui portent les casquettes, ceux qui portent les t-shirts, ceux qui portent les robes, les gandouras, les pagnes et tout ça, tout le monde va chier comme on nous dit. Donc, moi je... Est-ce que moi je m'occupe de ça? Tout le monde va payer. C'est ça, non? Hey, tu vas pas porter la casquette là, aller à l'hôpital? Et on va dire, bon, comme toi tu as la casquette, tu n'auras plus d'ordonnance. Voilà les médicaments. C'est pas parce que tu vas habiller ton enfant en t-shirt qu'il ne va pas payer la scolarité. Et chez nous, on dit 1000 poussins rassemblés font peur quand même à l'épervier. Mais dès qu'il y a la débandade, c'est fini. Il y a quelque chose qui va nous tuer tous. C'est l'expression « Ah, je me cherche ». Et tu vois quelqu'un qui dit « Je me cherche ». Où est-ce qu'il est pour se chercher? Et j'ai coutume de dire, personne n'aura un avenir dans un pays qui n'en a pas. Et je dis souvent, quand vous voyez à la télévision tous ces Rwandais, tous ces Burundais, tous ces Congolais qui transportent leurs matelas, c'est des gens qui se sont cherchés. Et qui continuent à se chercher. Parce qu'ils se sont dit à un moment, non, 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 ça c'est pas mon affaire. Hey, mon problème, c'est de n'avoir pas de problème. Vous n'aurez pas de problème. Vous serez chez vous. Et les problèmes viendront vous trouver. Et si les problèmes viennent vous trouver à la maison, les problèmes vous mettent dehors. C'est pas, y a pas de problème, hein. Vous ne voulez pas vous battre, vous ne voulez pas des histoires. Vous regagnez votre maison, vous dites, hey, ça là, ah, moi je suis chez moi. Vous êtes chez vous. Jusqu'à ce que le problème vous cherche dans la rue, il ne vous trouve pas. Il vient à la maison. Et quand il vient vous trouver à la maison, il vous met dehors. Et c'est maintenant que vous sortez avec votre matelas et on dit que c'est un réfugié. C'est comme ça. Voilà. Vous ne pouvez pas avoir la tranquillité de vos lits doués et avoir la réussite dans des combats. Vous ne pouvez pas flirter avec des régimes. Vous ne pouvez pas tricher avec vous-même et vouloir des résultats. Il faut savoir ce qu'on veut. Il faut choisir. Et on dit ne pas choisir, c'est toujours choisir, parce que vous choisissez de ne pas choisir. Et ça, c'est un choix dangereux. La seule leçon, c'est la lutte.
As you may have understood from the Alpha Blondie song, we are focusing this part of the Amandla Radio on the fate of Norbert Zongo, a courageous and other courageous journals around the world who tell truth to power. Alfie Blondie's song is about Norbert Zongo, but he entitled it Journalists en Danger. After Blaise Compaoré overthrew and assassinated Thomas Sankara in 1987, life was very difficult for Compaoré's critics, and none more so than for critical journalists. It's a testament to Norbert Zongo's courage that he worked at one newspaper after another that was shut down and finally founded the newspaper L'Indépendant, which exposed extortion and impunity within the government of Burkina Faso's President Blaise Compaoré. Zongo was assassinated after his newspaper began investigating the brutal torture and murder of a driver who had worked for the brother of Compaoré. The death of Zongo led to a great deal of popular unhappiness and unrest, which was once again viciously repressed by the Compaoré regime. It also garnered a great deal of support from the international community, where calls for the end of the abuse of journalists and the apprehension and trial of the people who carried out Zongo's murder. The Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders have both championed his case over the years. While we commemorate Norbert Zongo's death 22 years ago, we have seen currently in Tanzania's recent election how the independent press has been muzzled and the opposition has been intimidated to allow the rulers to maintain their power. President Yoweri Museveni in Uganda has successfully used repression to make life completely untenable for critical media. And the leading opposition candidate, Bobby Wine, just last weekend had to cancel public rallies because of the danger to his partisans from police bullets and beatings. Africa, Afghanistan, Philippines, Mexico, these are dangerous times for journalists. Life and death is their lot, and intolerant rulers, including the incumbent idiot in the White House of the United States, threaten any media that disagrees or criticizes them. Grilla has been in the forefront of efforts to keep Norbert Zongo's name and cause part of the current historical memory. Grilla, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, will this year on Sunday, which is the 22nd anniversary of the assassination, organize a day of solidarity in honor of the memory of Norbert Zongo and in solidarity with the journalists assassinated and confronted with injustice. There will be discussion around the difficult conditions that investigative journalism face and their needs for liberty of expression and their oppression. There will be calling on UNESCO materials and the Observatory for Journalists also at UNESCO, and be showing extracts of a film on Norbert Zongo and other documentary testimony about the condition of journalists. The event will take place on Zoom, and you can go to the Grilla Facebook page, GRILA, GRILA Facebook page to look up the link, or contact GRILACAN, GRILACAN at gmail.com for information. Amandla Radio completely supports GRILA in this event.
So that just about wraps it up for us here on Amandla. Jazz Euphorium is coming up, but before we pass the microphone off to them, a big thank you to Samir Shaheen Hussein for having made his time available to us. I mean, he's a very busy and committed pediatrician, to say nothing of a very active activist, and you know, touring with this book and meeting with people. But he really made it a priority to sit down with Doug and me this week, and we really, really appreciate that. And my hat off to you, Doug, for suggesting that we talk to Samir, read his book, talk to him about it, and explore it on the show. So thank you so much for that. We'll be back next week. Have a good week and stay safe, folks.
Stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
Africa, you know.
La pandémie de COVID-19 est une situation sérieuse. Il faut continuer d'appliquer toutes les mesures de santé publique. Suivez les consignes locales sur les rassemblements, pratiquez la distanciation physique, lavez vos mains, portez un masque et téléchargez l'appli Alerte COVID. Si vous avez des symptômes, même légers, restez à la maison. Protégeons-nous les uns les autres. Détails au canada.ca/le coronavirus ou au 1-833-784-4397. Un message du gouvernement du Canada.
Sound.
C. K. K.
U.
T. T. 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
This is Sam from Cafe Java Myth. I'm watching Stanley Kubrick films, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, Jazz Euphorium.